Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in life, our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. So in this show, I'll bring you the latest research about controlling attention with brainwaves. A study from MIT showing that people can boost attention by manipulating their own alpha brainwaves. So then I'll speak to Dr. Margaret Rutherford, a clinical psychologist and the author of Perfectly Hidden Depression, How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Masks Your Depression. You can call us and talk to either me or Dr. Margaret. You can call us on the studio line if you like, 951-922-3532. Be sure to listen to my podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and share it with your friends. Give a review. Tell me what you want. Contact me. Go to Fujian.com and email me all the comments that you have, things you like, things you don't like, things you want me to change, topics you want to hear. I really want to hear from you. And we'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, and this is the tip of the week. Now, this week, I've been pondering on the concept of living in the present moment. I've been watching and observing and learning from young children. I had the opportunity to be with our grandchildren, which are 1 and 3, two of them, where I had like 4 or 5 days with them. And one thing that was really, really, really interesting is that being with them, observing them and playing with the children, you really see that they live in the moment. They'll have laughter, they'll create things, they'll imagine things, they'll get you all involved with all of it. Then they'll fall, they'll cry, or you don't give them something and they're going to cry and demand that they you do. And then they get angry because you do something they don't like. They're real, they're with their emotions, they're with their body, they're with their thoughts. And at every moment, they're just moving ahead, relating to what's going on outside at that moment and just living it fully. And then I had an opportunity to be with a friend who has cancer. And the cancer, although she went through radiation, they saw another spot in her body. So she went through the anxiety and all of that. And in our dialogue, it was this conversation of when you have death in front of you, then you begin getting real with life and every day. The conversation was, I really am grateful. For the first time in my life, I really look at what I have and I'm grateful. And every morning when I'm present, I wake up and I look at the sun and I look at the view and I enjoy the view. And I know that the past is past and I'm complete with it. And, you know, whenever I look at the future, this anxiety shows up and it's like, what is the future? You know, I'm gonna, you know, at one point, you know, I'm facing that I'm going to deteriorate and I'm going to die. So might as well, every day that I'm facing life, I'm becoming more grateful. And I live with this kind of a gratitude. And, you know, it brought up to me, which is, wow, like you look at two ends of the kind of life, the beginning, and as we get closer to being elderly or the end, and the concept of living every moment and how precious every moment is, and this wonder of the childhood and this gratitude of, you know, knowing that this will be taken away from me, it becomes so worthy. So the sense of future, for especially people who have terminal illnesses, becomes a loss. The past has been a loss, and all that becomes worthy is the present moment and the gratitude of experiencing every moment. So the gift of having and experiencing the wonder, being present, experiencing what is in front of us fully, and feeling grateful for this ongoing experience brings joy and fulfillment in life. And may your experience every moment of your life be fully and be fully expressed. So somehow we might not have to, we're no longer children, and we might not have to face death before we get grateful. Maybe every morning that we wake up, we just choose to be grateful and look at everything that is there as if we know someday it won't be there. We don't know when the someday is, but let's act as if someday it won't be there so we could definitely feel grateful. So I'm grateful to have all of you be with me. We'll be right back with research.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year.
Oh, yeah, it is. I love this. Having trouble paying attention? MIT neuroscientists may have a solution for you. Turn down your alpha brainwaves. In a new study, the researchers found that people can enhance their attention by controlling their own alpha brain waves, based on neurofeedback they receive as they perform a particular task. The study found that when subjects learn to suppress alpha waves in one hemisphere of their cortex, they were able to pay better attention to objects that appeared on the opposite side of their visual field. This is the first time that this cause and effect relationship has been seen, and it suggests that it may be possible for people to learn to improve their attention through neurofeedback. There's a lot of interest in using neurofeedback to try to help people with various brain disorders and behavioral problems. It is a completely non-invasive way of controlling and testing the role of different types of brain activity. It's unknown how long these effects might last and whether this kind of control could be achieved with other types of brain waves, such as the beta waves, which are linked to Parkinson's disease. I didn't know that. I really have to study and see how the beta waves and Parkinson's are. So the researchers are now planning additional studies of whether this type of neurofeedback training might help people suffering from attentional or other neurological disorders, alpha and attention. There are millions of neurons in the brain, and their combined electrical signals generate oscillations known as brain waves. Alpha waves, which oscillate in the frequency of 8 to 12 hertz, are believed to play a role in filtering out distracting sensory information. Previous studies have shown a strong correlation between attention and alpha brainwaves, particularly in the parietal cortex. In humans and in animal studies, a decrease in alpha waves has been linked to enhanced attention. However, it was unclear if alpha waves control attention or are just a byproduct of some other process that governs attention. To test whether alpha waves actually regulate attention, the researchers designed an experiment in which people were given real-time feedback on their alpha waves as they performed a task. Subjects were asked to look at grating pattern in the center of the screen and told to use mental effort to increase the contrast of the pattern as they looked at it, making it more visible. During the task, subjects were scanned using MEG, which reveals brain activity with milliseconds precision. The researchers measured alpha levels in both the left and the right hemisphere of the the cortex and calculated the degree of asymmetry between the two levels. As the asymmetry between the two hemispheres grew, the grating pattern became more visible, offering the participants real-time feedback. Although subjects were not told anything about what was happening after about 20 trials, which took about 10 minutes, they were able to increase contrast of the pattern. The MEG results indicated that they have done so by controlling the asymmetry of their alpha waves. After the experiment, the subject said they knew that they were controlling the contrast, but they did not know how they did it. So researchers say that we think the basis is conditional learning. Whenever you do a behavior and you receive a reward, you're reinforcing that behavior. People usually don't have any feedback on their brain activity, but when we provide it to them and reward them, they learn by practicing. Although the subjects were not consciously aware of how they were manipulating their brain waves, they were able to do it, and this success translated into enhanced attention on the opposite side of the visual field. As the subjects looked at the pattern in the center of the screen, the researchers flashed dots of light on either side of the screen. The participants had been told to ignore these flashes, but the researchers measured how their visual cortex responded to them. One group of participants were trained to suppress alpha waves in the left side of the brain, while the other was trained to suppress the right side of the brain. In those who have reduced alpha on the left side, their visual cortex showed a larger response to flashes of light on the right side of the screen, while those reduced alpha on the right side responded obviously more to the flash seen in the left one. Alpha manipulation really was controlling people's attention, even though they didn't have any clear understanding of how they were doing it. So after the neurofeedback training session ended, the researchers asked subjects to perform two additional tasks involve attention and found that enhanced attention persisted. In one experiment, subjects were asked to watch for grating patterns similar to what they had seen during the neurofeedback task to appear. And in some of the trials, they were told in advance to pay attention to one side of the visual field. But in others, they were just not given any direction. When the subjects were told to pay attention to one side, that instruction was a dominant factor in the way they looked. But when they were not giving any cues in advance, they tended to pay more attention to the side that they were actually favored during their neurofeedback training, or they were actually trained to do. In another task, participants were asked to look at the image such as a natural outdoor scene, urban scene, or computer-generated fractal shape. By tracking subjects' eye movements, the researchers found that people spend more time looking at the side that their alpha waves had trained them to pay attention to. It is promising that the effect did seem persist afterward. I was in Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago, and it was interesting because I was writing a book. And first I wanted to write the book, and my brain was everywhere. So I went on YouTube and I found the music that said actually for concentration, and it had the beta wave and the concentration. So I put that as I was writing the book. It was the best 3 hours that I can tell you that I was working. I was working fast and it was so productive. So the next day I woke up and I thought, okay, you know, I want to do like deep meditation. And I went on and got another music, which actually was for deep, deep meditation. And it brought the alpha and the theta wave. And I listened to that and it got me so deep, so fast. And then I came out of the meditation and I'm trying to like write and, you know, my brain is fuzzy again. And I'm still in kind of like a meditative state, not coming out. And then I went back and I put that concentration music again, which is a binaural beat. And I was like zooming in 5 minutes again, which is again the concept of working on the brainwaves. Now, neurofeedback is something that you do with a computer where the computer gives you feedback. So you practice on your own on how to do this on your own, which is beautiful. But this is different than, you know, if you don't have this neurofeedback, guess what? Go to YouTube, find the brainwaves that you want to have, put it on and support yourself for now until you learn how to do it on your own. Okay, now I'm excited to tell you about Dr. Margaret Rutherford. She is a clinical psychologist in private practice with more than 25 years of experience treating individuals and couples for depression, anxiety, and relationship issues. She also offers her compassionate and common sense therapeutic style to the general public through her popular blog and podcast with the goal of decreasing the stigma around psychological treatment. Her podcast and her shows on Perfectly Hidden Depression, which is the name of her book, have reached thousands as she sheds light on this overlooked presentation of this disease. So welcome to my show.
Thank you, Fujian. Sorry, Fujian. I really appreciate being here.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Here in Arkansas, it's cold as kraut, and I'm kind of ready for that. I love the cold weather. I love the seasons here in Arkansas.
Okay, we've had some rain, and I'm loving the rain. It's been pouring. Last night, it was pouring so much. It was like banging on the roof, but you know, we need it in California. We always need some rain in California.
Yeah,
so it was nice. So you termed the perfectly hidden depression. So how come you called it the perfectly hidden depression?
Well, you know, it was back in April of 2014, Fujian, and I was by that time writing a weekly blog post. And so I just sat down and started thinking about some of the people that I had seen through the years that had not really presented with depression in the way that was classic. And I just sort of came up with the name of the post, which is "The Perfectly Hidden Depressed Person, Are You One?" And the post went viral. And then when it was on the Huffington Post, I had forgotten that I had left my email on the post. And 200 emails later, people saying, "This is me. I can't believe you figured this out. How do you know about this? Can I talk to you?" One woman very poignantly and tragically said, "I was going to hurt myself today, but I'm going to go home and talk to my family." So I decided I'd come upon a term that was meaningful for some people, obviously. And the more I wrote about it, the more people reached out to me and wanted to actually be interviewed by me. A brain surgeon, a motivational speaker, an advertising exec saying, "We look perfect to other people. We look like we have it all together, but we are lonely. We are despairing. We look anxious, worried, need to control, but no one knows that we can't access our painful emotion, and we are struggling. We don't know what to call it. And so you calling it depression really, although it's something I would never say myself, I can understand how it is depression. It's just another form of depression."
And I know that a lot of clients that come to my office, and when they do have that, they actually feel ashamed of even being sad or upset about it. So because they think, you know, I have everything. Everything's going well. I don't have the right to be depressed. Look at all these other people who don't have it and they're depressed. And they look at everything that they have as far as, you know, tangible items and the qualities that they have that they make it, and don't give themselves the right to be connected with that part of themselves that gets disconnected from themselves.
Exactly. In fact, what I sat down and sort of did and from my clinical experience, not research, but clinical experience, was I call perfectly hidden depression a syndrome, just like codependence is a syndrome. And I came up with 10 traits or commonly shared characteristics of perfectly hidden depression, came up with a questionnaire that you could take that, you know, would indicate where on the spectrum you might fall. But one of those traits was counting your blessings and doing that as a life value. Like, I have to count my blessings because I have so many of them. And what people like this don't understand is that blessings have an underbelly that is also, I mean, you have a very popular show. You're a busy psychologist, psychotherapist, and yet I'm sure there are times you get tired and that this is difficult for you. And so every blessing has its things that are underneath that people who are perfectionists, and especially this kind of perfectionist, a perfectionism that's very fueled by shame, mm-hmm. are not people who will ever admit that they're, in fact, they sort of look at me when I first say it, "What are you talking about? I'm not depressed." But I've had other people in my practice who are farther along in their treatment say, "Yes, my gut was telling me something was wrong. And I, one night at 2 o'clock in the morning, thought, I'll look up depression. And then they say, I'm nowhere there. I'm not depressed. I'm engaged. I mean, I love my life. I have a busy life. I'm successful. I don't fit any of these criteria. And they, just like you just said a few minutes ago, they shame themselves for even looking. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my gosh, how could I have completely forgotten how blessed I am? And then they stay away from the topic altogether.
Right. So you say that if you have a highly perfectionist and have a constant critical and shaming inner voice, or demonstrate a heightened or excessive sense of responsibility, or detach from painful emotions by staying in your head and actively shutting them off, worry and need to control yourself and your environment, intensely focus on tasks using accomplishments to feel valuable, focus on the well-being of others, but don't allow them into your own inner world.
Right.
Discount personal hurt or sorrow and struggle with self-compassion, and may have an accompanying mental illness issue like eating disorder or panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and addiction, and believe strongly in counting your blessings as the foundation of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
May enjoy success within a professional structure, but struggle with the emotional intimacy and relationship. Something that you said here, which is interesting for me, because when we come to talk about perfectionism, many times I know myself as a therapist have really looked at perfectionism from the concept of anxiety, and sometimes even the concept of like obsessive compulsive disorder, or just the obsessive part, which, you know, there's no perfect. And sometimes we deal with it as therapists as the concept of, okay, let's look at reality.
Right.
And the reality is, and then we'll go through the, you know, the reality check with them. And it's like, what do you even call perfect? And then we open up all of that as if we're doing working with people who have OCD, and we're trying to challenge their way of thinking of something about that. So I think most of us in the world have put the perfectionism under the category of anxiety.
Exactly.
And you have brought it into a different layer. You are bringing it into the category of depression. And I know for many people who are listening to us, they're like, these categories might blur for sure. Many people, because, you know, they're kind of all there. So, you know, they're like, well, of course, they're all there. And yes, of course, they're all there. But I think that what, you know, because in order to look at it from a treatment perspective and a person knowing where they need to look, it's also important that you brought it into the world of depression. Tell me, what was that like? What brought you to put this in the depression category?
Because, Fujian, I had people coming in who identified with some of the things I had written, and they wanted to come see me, right? And these people who I interviewed wanted to tell me that the only thing that brings them into therapy is the fact that they're thinking about killing themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And so usually, you know, suicidality is not necessarily associated with anxiety. It's obviously associated with depressions.
Yes.
And so I've had more than one person leave my practice who never walked in my door and said the first, second, or third, or fourth, even fourth session, I'm thinking about dying and taking my own life. At the end of treatment, they look at me and say, you know, when I walked in your door, I had a young woman who was about to marry somebody that was abusive, but he was the perfect person for her, and she was living the perfect life. And her mother was perfectly happy, and she had a perfect eating disorder and a perfect job. And she said, I was so unhappy that I was 3 weeks after the wedding, because I had to do what I was everyone was expected, you know, expecting me to do. I was going to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I've heard that story over and over again from people who recognize that this kind of a pressure is very dangerous. There are some great Canadian researchers. Dr. Gordon Flett is one of them, FLETT, Dr. Paul Hewitt, there are others who have identify three different types of perfectionism. One is the one we think of mostly, which is self-oriented perfectionism, where you just expect yourself to be really good at things. In fact, you don't like making mistakes. You try very hard not to make mistakes. You are self-motivated and someone who really wants to achieve and strive for excellence. Then there are other-oriented perfectionists who expect perfectionism from others, okay? And those can sometimes go hand in hand. But what the research on suicidality and perfectionism is showing over and over again is that there's a third kind that's the most dangerous as far as suicidality, and it's called socially prescribed perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is you are up against this growing requests, growing expectations that your best must be better next time. That if you did a great presentation or you sold a product for your company that nobody thought you could sell, then you're slapped on the back and they go, "You're just such a go-getter. We're going to give you a lot harder things to do next time." And the pressure, whether you're a volunteer and you throw a great fundraiser, "Oh, we're going to have you do it next year because it'll be even bigger and better." And everything you do becomes this pressurized, incredibly lonely and what's the word I'm looking for? You feel like you're not going to get affirmation if it's not, you know, even better. And so that is a trap for people. But they don't know how to get out of that trap. They don't know how to delegate. They don't know what to do. So because they buy into the fact that they must meet the expectations of other people all the time. And that can lead to suicidality. And of course, our suicide rates are going out the wazoo, both here in the United States and internationally.
That's very true. I have also, like you said, had a lot of clients where they look at the next level of pressure, whether it's from family systems,
sure,
that they have to, you know, create, especially culturally, many cultures uphold a high level of achievement.
That's right.
And we do have suicide in a lot of different cultures in a higher rate because of what you just said, the expectation that they have to be someone and be only significant if they have created that, and they don't have any significance in the world if they're less than that. And also the concept of, I'm assuming that the concept of being less than will also feed into the conversation of the depression more than the anxiety, because you're always experiencing I'm less than, and you're always striving for something that is more. And that more is never defined. It doesn't matter. Wherever you are, it's not okay for you to be there. It just has to be somewhere else.
Right. You know, there's a great book. It came out, I want to say, 3-4 years ago. It was called What Made Maddie Run by Kate Fagan. And it was about a young woman named Maddie Holleran, who was a University of Pennsylvania track star. And she actually died by running off a parking, seven-story parking garage. And so what made Maddie run was like what made her run to her death. And her parents knew she was mildly depressed, but her Instagram looked great, her Snapchat looked great, her life looked great, except that she had this, what sounded like to me as I read the book, this socially prescribed, just never being able to feel like her best was okay. I've also been contacted by so many parents who said, "My son killed himself, and he was a straight-A student, and he'd been accepted by all these colleges that were incredible." And I've had some other people contact me and say, "Our children are picking this up." You know, one thing you mentioned a few minutes ago is, where do these people get this? I mean, how do they develop this strategy And I think there are a lot of roads to Rome here. You mentioned the cultural one. I think that's big. I think that you can grow up in a family where you were told you would never amount to anything. Mm-hmm. You grown up in a family where you were abused. You could grow up in a family where you had to take a very pseudo adult position, you know, and take care of brothers and sisters so your own needs were ignored. You can grow up in a family where they simply didn't allow you to talk about anger or sadness or fear. You were sent to your room until you could, you know, be nice, and or you were actually criticized. So there are lots of ways that you can formulate this idea that I must never show my vulnerability to the world because it is abused or criticized or it's invisible. And so you develop this strategy very, very early on. There's also a term called, you know, high functioning depression, where I think
yes.
kind of realize what they're doing. They know they're depressed and they know that I'm putting on a smile and I'm putting on this act for people. Basically, one of my ideas is that the people who are in this group of really, they develop this as children, aren't even aware anymore. You know, it's kind of like when you drive a car. You have to think about where your hands are and where your feet are and all this kind of thing. And gradually, you don't think about that at all. Sometimes we don't think about it enough. Well, these people are like that. They've grown unaware of this strategy of rigid compartmentalization, pushing anger, sadness, fear, shame. They don't push shame enough away enough, but they anything that could be troubling or vulnerable, they push away. So much so that they don't even think it's in their lives at all.
Right. It's a part of the norm.
Exactly. Yeah. And so another woman comes to mind who had been terribly abused by a boyfriend sexually in college. And she and her husband were having sexual problems. And she finally started connecting the dots between that she'd grown up in a family where you weren't supposed to talk about anything that was sad or made you angry, that she had just simply said to herself after this event, after these years of abuse, I'm never going to let anybody control me again. So she didn't, but yep. she also didn't let anybody in mm-hmm. again. So there are lots of people out there like this, and they are successful. They are engaged. They could be one of your best friends, and all of a sudden you think, I really don't know much about them. So,
yes. Now you also in your book, The Perfectly Hidden Depression, talk about five stages of healing that makes up the core of the treatment strategy. And the first one is consciousness, becoming aware. So share with us a little bit about that.
Well, that's kind of what we've been talking about. People with perfectionism just get told, this is so great. This is not a trait that's dangerous. It's one of your best traits. Mm-hmm. And so they have to come to realize that this is a problem for them, that always keeping themselves at this level of commitment and engagement and super engagement and super focus is really destructive for them. And this is a huge realization. I mean, of course, Dr. Brené Brown's work has been extremely helpful in this way, where people are going, oh, you mean I can be vulnerable and not give up my strengths and my power? In fact, vulnerability is strength. I mean, those kinds of recognitions are so important and are really You know, like anything in mental health, if you don't think your anxiety is a problem, if you don't think your nightmares are a problem, if you don't think your brain fog is a problem, then, you know, you have to say, well, yeah, that is a problem in my life before you're able to recognize it and start working on it.
And I think that you also talk about commitment as a part of the healing. As you were talking about the consciousness, what shows up for me is also, you know, there has to be a shift of the where we value significance on, because I think where we put in the significance and the achievements and who I am, if I've achieved, and always looking at somebody who's going to obviously achieve more. Or they're better than you, or younger than you, or older than you, or richer than you, or whatever, you know, taller or shorter,
right.
You know,
right.
there's always somebody who you're going to say, oh, they're better than me. And then your significance becomes part of that. So I'm also assuming that shifting that significance and allowing the significance and, you know, who you are as a person to be who you are versus
imperfect. Right. You're such a great point. Yes. And in fact, I think commitment is one of the hardest things for these folks because they do so abjectly fear giving up any of that sense of impervious nature or they can get anything done if you ask them. And that is their whole identity is wrapped up in I am that person and everybody knows me as that person. And if I lose that, then what will I have? They also, during the commitment process, I've seen people tell me that it's taking too much time. You know, they're so perfectionistic that we'll start and we'll have 6 or 7 sessions or even a month or 2 months or 3 months. And they go, okay, I'm ready for this to, like, let's wrap this up.
Be done.
Be done. And they've got a lot of grieving to do. So there are lots of hurdles in the commitment process. You can choose things that are too hard because guess what? You are used to choosing things that are too hard. So you have to sort of confront that you want to go slowly enough to really begin to process how you became this way, what you're afraid of, to your point, of losing, and then gradually begin to understand, oh, but look what I gain. I gain freedom. I gain self-acceptance. In fact, I think that really Andrew Solomon says the opposite of depression, classic depression, is vitality. And I think the opposite of perfectly hidden depression is self-acceptance, mm-hmm. where you don't define your strengths as being any more part of you than you do your vulnerabilities, that both define you and that's you can accept that. But there's a lot that has to go on in the interim before someone with perfectly hidden depression can allow themselves to really claim that. I remember a girl I worked with who actually also, she presented with an eating disorder, and we began working on this perfectly hidden depression because about the third session she said, oh yeah, I heard you on Periscope talking about perfectly hidden depression. That's really why I'm here. And when she began to adopt better eating behavior, she said, I sit every night and I cry and feel like I'm giving up the one thing that I can count on, which is my thinness, but also people are attracted to me because of that. And I feel perfect when I am a certain weight. Now, all of us who've worked with people with eating disorders know that's pretty common, right. But it's that connection with the emotion of it, with the pain of it, of giving it up. And it's the pain of giving up this sense of a shield. It's a shield. It's a cloak. Harry Potter had his invisibility cloak, right? And, you know, he became very vulnerable when he didn't have it. Well, people with perfectly hidden depression or who can identify with it have to learn other ways of setting boundaries with people. And so keeping themselves safe rather than hiding, rather than not talking about themselves in a real way.
And I also, as I'm hearing you, what comes up for me, there's also this fear of other people's judgment because, you know, people have become this kind of perfectionism because they've also received a lot of positive feedback from other people. So they've also got their significance from that type of a positive feedback. And although internally they might say, you know, that maybe I'm vulnerable and vulnerable is strength, but externally they've created, or it was created for them, and they've fed into it, or they created this feedback loop of, you know, hey, hey, rah, rah, go, go, next one, you know, and all of that. And the confrontation of going back and looking at who you are and what you have to let go and what you created, it must be crashing. It must be very, very deep. And it's a deep work, but they have to actually look at that part of themselves and confront that part of themselves. And that's your third treatment strategy of confrontation. And I'm sensing that you have to really, really be true to yourself to confront all of these angles.
I couldn't agree more, and I'm glad you brought up that point. A man comes to mind who, I won't tell his whole story because it would be too long, but he had been very enmeshed with his mother, and he had been a great football star. He'd been a wonderful pianist. Everything he touched that she wanted him to do, he did extremely well. And just like you say, he built this sense of, I must do everything that other people expect of me, and if I do it really well, I'll be happy. Well, he found out he wasn't happy. He made a lot of mistakes in life, and he ended wanting to end his life. And then he got hospitalized, and I saw him after that. And I remember one of the most poignant moments. It was well into treatment, and he said, I found a picture of myself when I was six, and I wanted to tell that little boy, don't grow up, because all you're going to do is make mistakes after you grow up, and you're not going to be good at everything. Just stay six. And there were, a lot of these people don't cry very much, but he had tears in his eyes when he said it, because you could hear the fear of your life is going to get out of control and you must hide it. And so this felt needed when he was a child, that he had to maintain this perfection, this good at everything. But eventually life caught up with him, and he had a bunch of affairs, actually. And so he now realizes that there is such merit in being able to not do something well. And he's a wonderful father, and he's actually taught that to his children. It's just applying it to himself that's tough. And you're right, confronting those rules, who you were trying to please, what you learned about what makes you really a lovable, valuable person, is that's that confrontation part. And then deciding, am I still following those rules? And if so, which ones do I want to change? And that is very difficult work.
And sometimes, you know, if you're working in the corporate world or a different side of where, you know, the world is telling you, you got to go, 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 go. And my assumption from what you're saying is that, yes, we do live in a society and in a work that, you know, it's tangibly, you have to have achievements to move forward. But so for people who are listening to us and saying, well, you know, what am I going to do? Just not be perfect. I'm going to be fired. Nobody wants me and all of that. So what is it that I'm going to accept? But I'm also hearing from you saying, well, you're going to excel the way you're going to excel. You just don't have to be caught in it. Like, you can't do this in the price of losing yourself. There has to be a connection with you. You matter. And if you're not there within that robotic concept that is going forward, you're going to collapse. So you got to connect with who you are and grow, versus build this, you know, falsified concept and just move forward with you leaving yourself behind, because the self that you just left behind, it's going to crash at one point.
It will. The pressure will get to you. You know, we're in the part of Arkansas where Walmart is based. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the kind of pressure that Walmart, either vendors and all the Walmart people have. And so I remember a man I worked with who didn't come in for this, but really identified with it. And his exterior and his modus operandi had been to be the best team leader and to expect the best out of his people and to expect the best out of himself constantly. And as he began to do this work and began to have more self-compassion, he went to his supervisor and said, you know, people often ask to get off my team, and I want to change the way I supervise. And so they sent in some trainings about how to really tune into the potential of the people that work for you and how to actually do that without being a taskmaster. He came back about a year later to discuss some things that were happening in his marriage, and he said, you're not going to believe what happened. And I said, what? He said, people started asking to be on my team. Wow. Because the compassion I could show myself, I could also show them. And rather than it being an obstacle to success, it turned out to be he was even more successful. You know, you can get in a rut of what you think is really going to attract people and going to make you successful and is going to put you ahead of the curve. When I first began on social media, I had a choice to make, and I don't know what your choice is, but the choice I had to make was I'm going to reveal my own mental health struggles, and I decided to do so. I have panic disorder, and I have a history of anorexia, and I have two divorces, and I don't talk about that constantly on my podcast or website, but I've fully admitted it. And it's been amazing to me that where my fear, my perfectionistic self said, oh my gosh, people are going to say, well, I don't want to go to you, or you don't know what you're talking about, and you can't even completely heal yourself. Rather, what happened was when I let my own vulnerabilities out of the bag, so to speak, people were writing me, and I got many more followers than I had, because people say, oh, you're vulnerable too. You're imperfect as well. So I understand the corporate, well, I don't understand as much as a therapist can. I've certainly had a lot of people in it, and I know the stress of it, but there is a way to handle that stress that is far more, going to be far more productive for you in the long run,
So the fourth one was connection and connecting to yourself. And then the fifth one is change.
Yes.
So now that you've confronted yourself, now that you have been conscious of what's going on, now that you have a commitment you're looking at a commitment to you versus commitment to all of these, you know, pseudo you, and then you confront all of those, and then you connect with yourself, then you look at the change.
It's time to change. I don't know about you again, but in my 25 years of being a therapist, I have great respect for insight. I think it gives you context. It helps you connect the dots. You follow the breadcrumbs through your life and you kind of go, oh, this is how this all fits together. This is why I am who I am. But where you get your hope is in behavior change. When you begin doing something differently, saying something differently, thinking something differently, then you feel like you're moving forward. And rather than that's why I have a whole chapter on what will be the subtle and not so subtle changes that you will begin to make in your behavior, not just in your thinking or your emotional well-being, but in your behavior, where you can say, okay, you know, I actually checked in with myself and I decided, rather than sitting here at my desk for another hour, I'm going to go get a glass of water. I mean, simple things, just checking in with yourself. I'm going to decide this afternoon I'm going to play rather than, and I don't really care if the people on my committee see me swinging on a swing in the park. I'm still going to play. I'm going to have a few hours away from my work. So it's how you begin to change that behavior. And again, I think sometimes very subtle ways and then not so subtle ways.
So we have, so everyone who's listening or watching us, please get this book, Perfectly Hidden Depression, How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Masks Your Depression. And I think that most people can feel a little bit of a connection with this concept of perfectionism, and to look at what it is that you guys are holding on to, the image that you're holding on to, and you know, that knowing that you're worthy, that what's behind the image is the real you, and it needs to be connected to, it needs to be living fully out there. And this book can support you. And it has amazing, you got really amazing pieces of giving people tools as I was reading it. So the tools are in the chapters. The chapters are not at all like clinical work, because we're both clinicians, so we're talking from that perspective. But the chapters are really written to you. A lot of great stories, so you can find yourself in those stories, and a lot of tips, like through the chapters, there's just jewels of tips that are being given to you where you can work on yourself and really, you know, connect to yourself as the five strategies that we were talking about there in every single chapter that you could look at. So go get it. Okay. So Perfectly Hidden Depression, How to Break Free from the Perfectionism That Masks Your Depression. Margaret, where can the people find you?
My website is drmargaretrutherford.com. My podcast is The Self Work podcast, SELFWORK, with Dr. Margaret Rutherford, and I'm on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, iTunes, all over the place. I'm on Instagram. I actually also have a closed Facebook group at facebook.com/group/selfwork. And the book is in Barnes & Noble. It's obviously on Amazon. It's in your indie books. And I would love to have your listeners join me and your viewers join me and learn more about it. And I talk about it a lot more than perfectly in depression. In 25 years,
you've dealt with a lot.
I've dealt with a lot. So, and I'm honored by that, actually, that people have come my way. So I would love to have your listeners and viewers. And I want to thank you again, Fujian, for your attention and your support. And this has been a great interview. Thank you for you've actually read the book, which is great, and looked at the book. So I more than appreciate that.
Thank you. If you could say something that we haven't said throughout the time, and it's still part of what your experience is, whether it's about the book or, you know, the privilege that you and I have had to work with people, and you really want in 1 minute for people to know, what would that be?
Well, I think that these kinds, I'll go on and talk to the perfectionists in the crowd, because I do think that this book speaks especially to them, especially when it's fueled by shame, that a lot of people think of therapy, and you and I know this, as going back and blaming your parents or finding reasons why, you know, not taking responsibility for yourself. And if anything, a perfectionist is not going to want not to take responsibility. That's not what good therapy is about at all. Good therapy is about acknowledgement. I need to acknowledge how I became who I became, and then decide, okay, what do I still want to live by? What makes sense? What is constructive and not destructive in my life? But what do I want to change? And again, what we talked about before, where I think you get your hope is when your behavior changes. And so all you people who are saying, well, I don't know if I want to go into therapy because I'd just be whining, and therapy is extremely hard work. And I am a therapist because I got really good therapy, and I got some bad therapy, but I got some good therapy. And I think it can be very, very helpful. But I will say that if you identify with perfectly hidden depression, you may have to tell your therapist, you may have to walk in and tell your doctor, I am not who I'm going to try to convince you I am.
Right.
Beautiful. Because I need you not to believe that.
Beautiful. Yes. I also became a therapist because I had good therapists, and had to really face and confront a lot of the things for myself. So thank you so much for being on my show. It was great to have you. I learned a lot from your book, and it was an honor to have you and share you with my audience. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Until I be with you next week. Bye-bye.